Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. Coming up on 11 months of the Out of the Trenches podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and share on iTunes, Stitcher, and any of the sites where you download the podcast. It'll bring more listeners in. And also please share and promote on social media. Thank you.
My next guest is Kyle Hamstra. Originally from DeMont, Indiana, Kyle moved from North Carolina in 2002. After teaching fifth grade math and science for over 14 years at Davis Drive Elementary in Cary, North Carolina, Kyle is now an elementary STEM specialist serving 1,000 students weekly. Kyle is very interested in all things STEM, curriculum design, leadership, and being a connected educator to learn from his professional network daily. Welcome to the podcast, Kyle.
Dr. Dana Goodyear, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Which time to choose? I'm definitely going to have to go back to my very first year of teaching. I would say as I entered the profession, for sure, that one comes to mind without a doubt. And it remains one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about beginning teachers and supporting beginning teachers nowadays, you know, having lived my own journey and surviving, I should say. The transition from college to beyond is not just a career starting line, but it's also a huge life adjustment and change. And so there's a whole story where if I told you, Dr. Goodyear, you would not believe my journey from a small town in Indiana to where I ended up in my first year of teaching, how I landed my first job, you might say. It's things like I took a right turn instead of a left turn, or I found a school on a laminated map at a gas station.
Wow.
And this is a lamination. This is like 10 point lamination. This was, this was like maybe almost even before MapQuest days. There's no smartphone. There's no, GPS, or if there was, I didn't know about it or have access to it, or it was really expensive, something like that. So I circled five schools on this laminated map at a gas station, and I tried to find one of them, and I got lost. Talking like 30 to 40 miles lost. In Indiana, roads intersect, at 90 degrees. It's kind of like a grid. It might be easier to navigate in some ways. And in the South, especially North Carolina, roads are different. Sometimes they curve, they meander. It's almost like symbolic of the journey of life in a way, I guess. Especially this one. And I ended up staying at a Red Roof Inn, and it's a long story, but if I told you that, you would just have the takeaway that it was truly divine. Anyway, the school that I ended up at happened to have an administrator there who had also graduated from Purdue University in Indiana, and we made an instant connection, and I was fortunate, to say the least, that I was accepted for my position. I didn't know it at the time, but the school had a lot of applicants for this one teaching position. And it ended up being in fifth grade math and science. That whole story right there could be, we're going to need another two or three episodes. That is precious to me because it actually really happened, and it informed literally every step of the way to follow. And so I am now from small town Indiana, 22 years old, about 600 miles away from anything I've ever known. I don't know a single person. And I come into this place, this fifth grade teaching position, teaching math and science. in a very academically high performing school and on a team with veteran educators who were really good. And so part of me was, you know, looking back, so grateful that I even had that opportunity, really, or maybe even privileged in a way that that previous experiences had paved the way to make that opportunity possible. But I, and then there was another part of you who's thinking, you know, I don't belong. Mm-hmm. What am I? I don't know anything. And it seems like they're way down or farther advanced in their years in their career, and I'm not. I'm here, and I'm maybe feeling lonely or by myself or possibly even inadequate because I just don't know some things and I don't know what I don't know. It's really cool, but also I'm terrified. This is a hard place. One of the biggest challenges as a first year teacher was that I believe I incredibly underestimated the hard work of what it is to be a classroom teacher and to do it well and to continue doing it well in the future. It's hard work. And usually, you know, if you're doing it right, it doesn't get easier because you're continually improving to become better for your students and in your craft and in your career. And so I found myself on a team that was amazing. And I think there were seven of us on that team. We're talking 2002. And there was another male teacher on the team who was really good at what he did. Every student in the school wanted to be in his class. And he was the expert in math. He was the math man. Math was his subject, his area. Every child in the school knew him. All the parents knew him. They all, you know, and I was thinking, man, this is, wow, you know, that he's really good. I want to be good too. And it kind of, I was grateful for his mentoring, and he's still a great teacher and a great guy. And I came to a place though, I think halfway through my first year in teaching, where I thought, how can I add value to the team? You know, I'm here and I'm listening, which is important when you're entering a place of things that you don't know. And you're seeking to understand and you're seeking to grow. I literally come to the planning sessions. I sit and I listen. I take free stuff from them and I walk away. So there kind of came a point where I felt, I guess, personally convicted that what I needed to start contributing, you know, what value can I add to this team? Where is my place or my niche that I could start investing and I could start being part of the process, you know? And so I felt personally convicted, I guess. And I also wanted to add value to this team because I really admired this team and this opportunity. And so I thought, well, he's really good at math. And there was another teacher down the hall who's really good in reading the two tested subjects, right? At the time anyway. And I thought, well, what about science? You know, no one is really focusing on science as much. I understand it's not a tested subject, but science is really cool. How could we start making some of our science lessons better? Maybe that's my angle. Maybe that's my place where I could add value to the team. Maybe I could come with resources, with ideas to make a lesson plan better, or, you know, to better integrate with math, or to make it more efficient, right? So a lot of science learning experiences take time to set up because there can be a lot of hands-on materials, and you wanna make it as meaningful as you can for and with kids. And so maybe that could be my angle. And so that's kind of where I started to invest in places where I thought I could add value to the team. A little while later, like maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years later, science became a tested subject in the state of North Carolina. So now in fifth grade, we currently have 3 tested subjects, math, reading, and science. And so now all of a sudden, a lot of that science background knowledge and research and making lessons a little bit better, perhaps, each year was starting to come into view. Mm-hmm. It was starting to come into fruition. It was starting to mean more in the big picture to more stakeholders than just me. Mm-hmm. That's how I would say it. I tell you what, though, that first year of teaching was incredibly challenging. I sincerely mean this when I've said this 100 times on social media and face-to-face. I want my first class back.
Why do you want to have them back? What do you think you would do differently?
I think pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. These students were phenomenal. They were, and still are. Mm-hmm. Just what an awesome class. And really my first 3, 4, 5 classes, I want them back now. I think the experience would be different. Mm-hmm. I was so focused on what kind of value could I bring to the team in terms of content, mm-hmm. in terms of academics. So making a lesson better. And I don't know if I fully took advantage of or realized the importance of connecting with the mind by going through the heart. Mm-hmm. I would have done so much more to get to know the kids better and the families better and to build those relationships better, because that ultimately is what makes a learning experience better. Mm-hmm. Right? It's that personal connection. It's not speaking or talking at kids. It's having conversations with kids. It's not me teaching, it's us learning together. Mm-hmm. And I would have invested so much more in the relational pieces of the entire experience. Mm-hmm. I want the first class back. We made it through together.
Yeah, and I think those are common things that we reflect on as educators after years of experience, that, you know, these are things we would have done differently. But I think everybody struggles through that first year. And, you know, there are a lot of things that we take away, right, that we could have done differently. And I think the fact that you are still focused on making science meaningful and building upon the hands-on curriculum still was very inspiring, you know, to try to build that up over those first several years. You also talked to me a little bit in the pre-chat about a calendar that you had that first year of teaching. Oh my,
you had to bring it back. Yes, and again, that was on my mind this past summer as we were shelter in place or something like it for a while with COVID. My wife and I finally cleaned out the garage, talking like an 8 to 10 day clean. Mm-hmm. Wake up early, clean all day, go to bed. And that was it. It was good because I found a lot of artifacts and it brought me back to certain places. And it made me choose criteria for why I would keep something or get rid of it. Mm-hmm. Or I'd take a picture of it, or why that thing mattered so much to me in that moment in my life. And it must matter so much still that I keep it. So one of the things that I thought I would run across, and I might have, because the cleaning continues. You know, eventually it's just piles here and piles. A calendar. So my first year of teaching, the days were long and full of opportunity, and I was well supported. I want to add, by the way, too. I'm not saying that there wasn't supports in place by my team, school, district. There were, and they were good. Mm-hmm. I possibly was maturing, you know, or needing to, and growing, and I literally, this is how my first year of teaching went. And there's a statistic out there of first year teachers who, if they make it past, what is it, year 3 or year 5, then mm-hmm. they'll go on. But otherwise, what, like half the teachers who enter the profession quit after year 3? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So I would go home. I would take this calendar. So, and this is the manual calendar that you hang on the wall. So again, I didn't have it on a smartphone, nothing like that yet. And I literally took a pen to this calendar every day. And on every single day of the school year, I had 2 columns, yes or no. And at night I would go home and check one of those two boxes for every school day of the year. Yes, I want to continue teaching, or no, I don't. And I think by the end of the year, it was, I think the yeses won by 8.
Mm-hmm.
It was that close. And I will say that to survive the first year in a meaningful way and end up wanting to invest more, that takes special perseverance. I believe mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that you have to want to be an educator.
Mm-hmm.
You have to want to do it. It's not something where you can kind of say, I'm a kind of educator. You're not mm-hmm. kind of want to do this, but not really. I think at the end of your first year, you're all in or not.
Yeah.
I fully believe that. And really, I mean, no parent wants their child in a classroom where the teacher's just kind of, you know, just there, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that is the true trench part of the story, the fact that you had that visual reminder when you were cleaning out your garage and realizing that it was that close, right? That that kind of based on how every day went, right? And we all have our, you know, tough days as an educator, but, you know, you persevered. You know, the 8 days with the yeses won, and you're still in education 19 years later and still making a difference. mm-hmm. We talked in the chat a little bit about how you got involved with standards-based grading, and you talked to me about being sent to a conference or a training back in 2005 and how you were in charge of kind of bringing standards-based grading to your building. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Whew. Yes, standards-based grading, I can look back and see that it was a benchmark from which I measured all future vision, all forward progress. I can look back at standards-based grading and realize that that was a moment that forever changed my philosophy in education. And so my principal, again, believing in me and giving me opportunity as a now, I think, third year teacher, she sent me to a workshop. Our district at the time was going to try this new initiative, or so that's what I thought it was, called standards-based grading, based on the book by Ken O'Connor, How to Grade for Learning. And it was all about that book. And I thought, okay, this will be a thing. And then maybe in a couple of years, it will go away.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are still doing it 15 years later. And I know why. And I'll share that. So I'm at this workshop as a third year teacher, knowing that my principal wants me to come back and present what I have learned from this workshop, present it back to the staff. Okay, so again, these staff members are incredibly way smarter than I am.
Mm-hmm.
They are veterans, they are experienced, they know good teaching. I'm a third year teacher, who am I to do this sort of thing? And because I knew that I was gonna be presenting, I took extra special notes.
Mm-hmm.
If I went back now, I would just, you know, set up a tripod and have my phone out and record the whole thing. Because I wanted to get it word for word. I took notes that were so detailed, because I knew I was going to have to present it. And the day before I presented to the staff, I spent like 4 hours making this, these handouts and trying to get my notes in an organized way that maybe the staff might appreciate and find meaningful, really, because we're actually going to implement this in our practice in the coming fall. And so in our district, what happened was along about 2005, elementary change from percentage-based grading to standards-based grading, while middle school and high school, the secondary, remained with percentage-based grading. And so I presented to my staff, and I found those notes the other day. I think it's about 4 pages long, even has a diagram at the end, and I realized that the main points are still there, but some things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so standards-based grading forever changes my philosophy moving forward. Here's a short story. I want to go back to my first year of teaching and that first class that I had that I want back tomorrow. I wish I had another chance. But so as a first year math teacher, I would have these pop quizzes. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, take out a sheet of paper, here's five questions about fractions or something like that. And so here's five questions. Most students, I'd say half got them all right, mm-hmm. and half of them got one wrong. So that's 4 out of 5. Well, what goes at the top of the paper is an 80%, 4 out of 5, right? So what is that, a C, C plus?
Yeah.
Somewhere in that range, depending on your school or district's scale, right? Your grading scale. So fifth graders went home with grades at the top of the paper that said 80% C. Mm-hmm. Or C plus, something like that. And immediately there were parent phone calls. There were conference requests. Mm-hmm. There were emails because not only, you know, had their child who was high performing academically, they just came home with a C on a math quiz. And it also came from a first year teacher. Mm-hmm. So what is going on? And I remember those conferences as more great learning opportunities. So, but that's 4 out of 5 and that's 80%. So the math was correct on a percentage based scale. But mm-hmm. what the parent, and I just talked to a parent about this the other day, what she was really communicating to me was saying, look, it's just one wrong. That's one wrong. So my child performed on grade level, so to speak. My child was demonstrated proficiency most of the time. It's 4 out of 5.
Yeah.
But on a percentage-based grading, you know, I was doing as I was told and as I thought everyone else was doing. So there's a disconnect here.
Yeah.
And in addition to, after basic needs of children are met and after you at least initiate the building relationships process, after all of those things, the learning and what happens in the classroom, I believe, as informed by standards-based grading, can really be classified into 3 different categories, right? Is this a work habit, number one? Number two, is it a conduct or behavior? Or number three, is it actual evidence of learning the academic content? Mm-hmm. So it's either work habits, conduct, or learning. And I believe that you can really classify many interactions and what happens in the classroom in one of those 3 categories in the context of relationships and the whole child. For me, that was the big takeaway for standards-based grading. When a teacher uses standards-based grading, they can immediately see that. And so if a child turns in a paper one day late, for example, that's a work habit. Mm-hmm. Right. So are you also going to average that into the academic learning? Because those are kind of 2 different things. They didn't really demonstrate that they didn't understand the content. They demonstrated that they might need to grow in a work habit area. And I just think that progress reports, report cards, if they had 3 columns, one for work habits, one for conduct or behaviors, and one for the academic content learning. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a game changer.
Yeah. I think it would help a lot too for schools to be more concise about how they grade if they're using standards, because for example, I see a lot of schools in the Denver area that, you know, I taught at one school that had full standards based, but they were, you know, they were doing 80% summative, 20% formative. And in a previous podcast with Dave Schmidto, we talked about maybe only the summative should count, right? My son's school, for example, they have the work habits and then they have the content grade. But when I looked at his report card for this past quarter, a lot of the grades were affected by the content grades were affected by him getting in assignments late or having missing assignments, which are more work habits. So that's, you know, it's kind of doing it right, like is the key. And, you know, you've been in a school that's been using standards based now for 15 years. So, you know, you've written several articles and blogs about standards based grading. And have you also taught, done like sessions? I think you've shared some of the places that you've given sessions about standards-based grading. Could you name some of those titles of different workshops that you've given and kind of the reactions you've gotten from educators?
Okay, yeah. So on the topic of standards-based grading itself, I have not presented other than at the one staff meeting to my original staff at my in my third year of teaching in my own school. So on that specific topic, with that title, no, yet standards-based grading has informed many of the presentations that I have given, and I've been fortunate to speak about at conferences and in just daily conversations, really. Because in the journey, I wanted to add value by going deep into the science. And then I really, standards-based grading just changed my entire philosophy. It really just rocked my world. And then I got to a little bit later and I started thinking about how can we make fifth grade science better? And how can we really supplement in the areas in which there might be gaps? Do we really even have the resources we need to teach science better? Because what standards-based grading does is it requires the educator to consistently go back to the standard. We have this kit. So are we going to teach the kit or are we teaching standards? And you might zoom out and say, well, we teach kids. Yes. And we are with kids. We are required to teach and learn standards. Yes. So how you innovate inside that box, I think that's how George Kuros phrases it. How you innovate inside that box. There's a world of opportunity, I believe. And so when you're looking at the standards and you're looking at your resources, do you teach the kit? No, we don't teach the kit. We don't teach the curriculum. We don't teach the unit. We're teaching and learning these standards. Do our resources align with our standards? Would they be considered standards-based? And so if you're using the standards-based grading, you are constantly coming back to the standard. Did this child really learn this or demonstrate proficiency or mastery? I don't know. Let me go back to the standard one more time and let me really justify the evidence I'm seeing or not seeing against the standard. It's this objective measuring that makes standards-based grading valuable. And not only that, but every time I come back to the standard, I get more familiar with my curriculum. And so now the quicker that I know the standards, the quicker an educator knows exactly what he or she is teaching and learning, the quicker you can get to a point of making decisions about differentiation.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to look at quality over quantity, or if you're going to look at equity over equality, then knowing, the quicker you get to the point where you know how to best differentiate for a child based on your relationship with the child, what you know about the child, the whole child, and in addition to your knowledge of those standards, I think it can be much more efficient.
You talked a little bit about the fact that you're writing blogs based on your experience with standards-based grading. You're using a green shade on the blog, similar to what is on the book cover of How to Grade for Learning by Ken O'Connor. And you're also doing some culture ed Twitter chats on grading this past year, because grading is such a big topic during the remote learning and the the hybrid learning during the pandemic. So talk to me a little bit about some of the titles that you've written for your blogs and some of the reactions on the Twitter chats that you've given.
So yes, the graphic for the blogs in that series about standards-based grading, the color scheme was very intentional. It's in my mind, a similar color scheme as Ken O'Connor's How to Grade for Learning. And I actually reached out to him on Twitter and he responded. And it was actually in that Twitter chat, Culture Ed Twitter chat, about our grading practices, especially amidst a pandemic. And I sometimes wonder, you know, can we look back a year from now, 5 years from now, will we look back in the on the pandemic era, on this 2020 year, in a moment in which we really examined, we really analyzed and potentially transformed this very traditional structure of our grading. Mm-hmm. Will this be a moment in which we do that? And conversations on Twitter, you know, they really told us a lot about each other, about education. And it was already there, but perhaps maybe I was more aware in seeing some of these conversations. Things like, should we force students to turn their cameras on? Mm-hmm. If their camera's not on, do we count them absent? You know, and again, through the lens of standards-based grading, I'm not sure if having the camera on or off is something that you can really take away from whether or not they learned a standard. Mm-hmm. That might be a work habit, if anything.
Yeah.
And I also wonder about the legalities and the ethics of that as well. But another one was, how do we punish students for turning work in late? Mm-hmm. You know, and during a pandemic, in the context of the whole child, really, you know, we may have done surveys. We may have seen, if they had the camera on, a glimpse of inside of someone else's house.
Yeah.
Which is interesting too. But when it comes down to it, we really don't have any idea what is happening on the other side of the screen, wherever the learner may be accessing whatever it is that we're offering on our side of the screen. We really have no idea. We're not sure, you know, of the, in a pandemic especially, who has access to devices. We really don't know if that device is being shared. Do we know the level of support for learning new things at home? Have we taken into account as well the attention span? Mm-hmm. You know, it's different when you try to translate or transfer a face-to-face lesson of the past into the online or blended format. Mm-hmm, it is mm-hmm. not always a smooth transfer. It's not always efficient, and it's not really always what's best. It's actually an entirely different experience. And you have to take into account all of those things if you're going to then give a student a grade based on mm-hmm. these conditions in the context of the whole child through the lens of standards-based grading and on, right? What a year. Wow.
Well, what has your experience been throughout the fall and going into second semester in terms of in-person or hybrid or remote? Have you been somewhat face-to-face? I know North Carolina is kind of a hodgepodge, just like Timber.
Yes. Yes. We have had a mix of experiences. Of course, in the spring, starting in March, I believe it's March 13th of 2020, it was entirely online. So, you know, that was shelter in place. And how about all the different terms as well, you know, and defining mm-hmm. what those mean for blended, hybrid, remote, in-person, and asynchronous, synchronous. Mm-hmm. So yes, we have resumed in-person classes for elementary schools on a three cohort rotation, beginning a little bit later this fall in 2020. Mm-hmm. And we have 2 weeks back to remote learning to finish out our first semester, and then starting the second semester, what that will be like might remain to be seen, but in a very simple way, very, very paraphrased. That's how I would reflect upon it. Mm-hmm.
So let's transition a little bit into your work with Twitter and kind of how you got into getting on Twitter. And I got on it several years after you, you know, what got you wanting to post and seeing the use of Twitter for educators?
Why? Dr. Dana Goodyear, how much time do you have? we might need another 10 episodes. Now, anyway, I want to say my journey has been different, I think, than many others. I want to say that my journey has been incredibly influenced and inspired, really, by so many educators who were already on Twitter and social media before me and who continue to do so now. And I really admire them. And I tweet several times, you know, I'm grateful for my PLN, my professional learning network. I'm grateful for this opportunity to have access to brilliant minds and to see examples of good teaching and being a good educator, maybe a good person. You know, I appreciate you. Thank you. Thank you for inspiring my journey. I was late to the game, I would say, joining in Twitter in 2013. Before 2013, I was opposed to all social media. It's bad, bad things. And now the reason why I wanted to join Twitter had nothing to do with people. And I know that sounds terrible. The reason why I love Twitter now is because I think that for so many more beyond the connections is that as adults, we also want to demonstrate good ways to use social media. We want to demonstrate quality digital citizenship. That's important because like in the pandemic, perhaps what we didn't have was a huge archive of online lessons so that educators could see examples of what good teaching looks like. You know, and maybe perhaps today in our current state with all things social media, especially Twitter, maybe we don't have examples of adults using social media in good ways. How can we use it for the good? So going back to fifth grade science, the weather unit for fifth grade science was challenging because you have a lot of abstract phenomena, a lot of abstract concepts that are that consist of weather, you know, that make up weather. So and the standards were challenging. So we have these abstract ideas and we want our 10 and 11 year olds to master them. Like, can you describe how a convection current forms and the difference between a sea breeze and a land breeze? Now, I don't know many adults that can do that. And so I saw that maybe there's room for us to supplement this fifth grade weather unit in science. And I was really excited about this. And so I just went out for it myself. I saw the kits and the resources that we had, and I thought maybe we could add some things to it. Maybe we could enhance them to make the science learning for fifth graders even more meaningful, relevant, and really more standards-based. So I would be out on vacation or on a trip or something. I'd be in a mountain in North Carolina, and I would see a waterfall, and I'd take a picture of it. Maybe it demonstrated the processes of weathering, erosion, and deposition. Maybe it was demonstrating gravity pulling water to the lowest point, or maybe it was like a simulated precipitation, like part of the water cycle. But anyway, I took a picture of it, or maybe a selfie or something silly like that. I don't know. And then I would be at the state fair, or I would be out shopping, or I would actually flip through the channels, I would see Jeopardy, and I would pause the TV on a Jeopardy question because it had something remotely to do with what we were teaching and learning in fifth grade science. And I would take a picture of it. I would find just so many opportunities of learning in the world all around me, and I would just take pictures. So I had all these pictures. I took them to Walmart and got them printed. And then I also bought double-sided tape, which was kind of a big deal for me, I think because it's expensive and I'm not really that crafty. I would tape these pictures to poster boards. And each of the four posters was a different major theme or unit in fifth grade science that we would be learning. And these are pictures from my life, my real world, my context. And I had them there, and I actually had students create speech bubbles, if that's what you call them, or comic bubbles. And I would say, and what does this have to do with what we're teaching and learning? How does it apply to your life in your real world, so to speak? And I actually wrote the standard under each one of those pictures and bubbles. And so then I thought about it, I thought, you know, it's not really about me. And so what if students also brought in their own pictures? And what if they shared how it was meaningful to them? And so we had a lot of physical artifacts and a lot of posters and pictures and tape and a lot of handwriting. And then Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I was open to the idea of joining to see if I could use it for something good in education. And so Twitter for me became that free digital space to store my resources to make fifth grade science, especially the weather unit, better. This is a true story. I came into Twitter by wanting to have a place where I could store pictures, videos, websites, anything that could be tweeted. I wanted to tweet it, and then I wanted to bring it up in class quickly for maybe the first 5 minutes and say, hey, check out my weekend. I did this. Oh, and hey, what do you know? Here's something that we're going to learn today. Or here's what I did. Have you ever been to this place, or have you ever seen this in your life too? And so that was it. And I would never, by the way, encourage elementary kids to go on social media necessarily, or to have their own Twitter account, because they're younger than 13 and all of that. So I want to make that very clear. I brought it up for myself. Twitter was my, like another space for me as an educator to store free resources digitally. So after about 100 pictures and 100 tweets, I want to bring something up from last week, and I had to scroll. And I had to scroll and scroll, and I couldn't find it. And then by that time, you're a few minutes into the lesson because I didn't set it up ahead of time because I was still a young teacher. And I didn't understand about the most underrated feature of Twitter is that search box, and how you can do searches with hashtags and multiple words. And it's awesome. So I thought, how can I access this tweet in less than 30 seconds? Because it was 100 tweets ago, it was last week, I'm not scrolling, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, what if I hashtagged it? And what if I hashtagged it with the exact standard that we're teaching and learning? So it's been likened to the Dewey Decimal System, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's this system of categorizing, really, but really it's standards-based hashtags. Mm-hmm. So the standards already exist. You just have to come up with your own hashtagging system. And then I can search that hashtag very quickly to find that one tweet. And by the way, the reverse is also true. When I continue to go out into beyond the classroom and live life and might see an example of something we were teaching and learning in fifth grade science, because I had checked that standard so frequently to see if how I was hashtagging it was correct, I got to become so familiar with all of the fifth grade science standards that I actually had them memorized. Mm-hmm. So now when I'm out, the reverse is true, that I can see standards-based learning opportunities first. Mm-hmm. And I know exactly what is standards-based and what is not, because I had hashtagged several similar concepts in tweets in the previous year or 7, 8, 9, 10 years now. So it's kind of like we were doing Twitter and hashtags with those poster boards before the digital version of Twitter, before I entered that space. And what's interesting is I think it was about a year or two maybe of using Twitter, I didn't realize that there were other people on it. I surely didn't understand the value and the potential to connect with other educators. And what about other fifth grade science teachers in North Carolina? Because I'm not the only one who might have the same challenge. What if every fifth grade science teacher in the state of North Carolina would also share just one standards-based artifact, picture, video, website, and they also tweeted it, just one? We would have a few thousand? At least artifacts or teachers communicating about what's happening in their space, sharing an idea for how they might have also taught or learned that standard, which could be incredibly valuable if you think about building an archive together. And so this idea of hashtag 180 was really based on a tweet that I saw by by George Kiros a few years ago, and I had it, and I think I still have it. And if I had that right, if this were the first time that he tweeted it, November 24, 2015, says, would you tweet that in one of his blogs? And he said, what if every teacher tweeted one thing a day that they did in their classroom to a school hashtag, and they took 5 minutes out of their day to read each other's tweets? Mm-hmm. What impact would that have on learning and school culture? And I thought that's so powerful. School hashtag could definitely impact school culture, you know, if educators are willing to enter that social media space for that reason of teaching and learning to make the culture better. I think that's powerful. And so I guess, looking back, kind of had my own spin on the same thing. In the first blog I wrote, I quoted something similar, and I also cited George Kiros as one who inspired it. I said, what if teachers tweeted examples of their curriculum and then they hashtag their tweets with their curriculum objectives or statements? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How might that enhance our teaching and learning together? So hashtag 180, the 180 comes from about 180 days in the school year. Even though I know not all states observe exactly 180 days, it might not necessarily be segmented into days, mm-hmm. as a period of time, but those are things that I would learn much later. it's just been a journey. It's been very valuable to me to have this archive for my own personal. That's how I viewed Twitter from the beginning, as an archive for standards-based resources. And I also wonder about the potential to develop the same kind of practice with educators throughout your own school, perhaps just down the hall, mm-hmm. that you don't ever get to see into their classroom, really, because you don't have the opportunity to observe each other. Or maybe in the school 2 miles down the road, there's a fifth grade teacher also challenged in that same standard. And maybe how about in the next district? Three districts over, how about 300 miles away on the other side of the state? Someone else could share an idea, a glimpse into their learning space or classroom. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's not like teachers pay teachers, where you're gonna find a whole lesson through standards-based hashtags and the hashtag 180 process. It's not like that, but it is about communicating different ways that we can make teaching and learning better together.
That concludes part one of my conversation with Kyle Hamstra. Tune in next week on April 14th for part two. In the meantime, find Kyle on Twitter at Kyle Hamstra and visit his website at hamstrahighlights.com.